says off air. Oh, here we go.
It doesn't say off air now. It's on air now, Kyle. It's on air now.
Okay, David Griggs, we have a live show to do. Hi, folks. This is Kyle Lamb. I'm here tonight. The first official bracketology podcast of this new season. It is 2014-15 college basketball season. We are officially in game week. It's November the 9th, 2014, and that means this Friday is the start of college basketball for real. I'm joined by a couple of the usual suspects. David Griggs, you heard mouthing off at the start, very open of the show. David, you're here. It's a new season. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, as much as I've enjoyed watching Div 1 teams that don't care and are just really trying to work on their weaknesses, blow out lower division teams that are just wanting to get paid, yeah, I'm ready for the regular season to start. We're going to get to this a little later. Everybody is – one of the things I think is kind of special is that it's not like football. Everyone truly does start out at zero. If the SWAC gets out there and wins 80% of their games, they'll have, half their teams in the rankings. They'll have great RPIs, and they'll be sending half their conference to the tournament. That being said, practically speaking, it's safe to say that there aren't many – we'll get to this a little later. There aren't that many great games this Friday.
I almost think this is a little unfair, David, because the teams get to start at zero. They start over with a zero record. Don't get to start over. You're banned from out of 350 schools. You're banned at how many of them now?
Well, banned is. I've been asked not to come back. That's not exactly the same as being banned. It's some of them.
But no, I think you're on
scrimmages. We're going to get to exhibitions, but I mean, they wouldn't even let me in to some of those close. They wouldn't let me in.
I know. It's a life. What a great life's great mysteries. And we're, of course, joined by a podcasting legend and Lee Delvecchio sporting another legendary background for us, the NCAA Division I's National Basketball Champion banner in his background. Lee, how are you doing tonight?
Good. That's two. That's three. And that's four. I'm doing spectacular. I'm having a good afternoon. Are you gentlemen ready for this Friday and 157 Division I men's basketball contests?
Yes, and 148 of them probably aren't going to be that exciting.
No, I can authoritatively state that when you consider the fact that 100 and of the 157, only 112 are D1 versus D1. By my poor math skills, that leaves us with 45 D1 versus body bag games. I will, of course, later in the podcast be picking out the pick of the litter there. But for now, I suppose we should probably deal with the 112 that are D1 versus D1 games.
Well, let's talk about the body bag. This is actually a good segue because this kind of brings us into a subject we want to talk about with the exhibition format. Now, we will talk about the Friday night. I think, like, David and I were talking off air, or more or less I was venting and David was listening to me, which is a rare time I get to speak around David. But we were talking this Friday night.
You're not as smart as I am.
this Friday night seems about as barren as I've ever seen for a first night. That says a lot. But the exhibition is interesting because the exhibition season, since the NCAA changed the rules several years ago, it's become pretty barren as well because basically, it used to be, colleges could load up on all these great exhibition teams like Athletes in Action and Marathon Oil and some of these other great traveling teams. And then, of course, the NCAA came in, made an issue of it, and said, no, you have to play NCAA teams in your exhibition games. And then they went a step further. Not only do you have to play a Division I team, but you can't play a Division I team in an exhibition. You can only play a Division I team in a closed scrimmage. Now, David, I just know you've been absolutely waiting all week to vent about this, so I'm going to give you the floor.
Well, the good news is, on Friday, it won't matter. The exhibition games will be over. It's just right now, if you want to see the game, that's all there is. And like you said, I'm glad Lee's here because I think he might actually be able to help out with some of the history. It used to be that if you wanted to, and not everybody did, you could schedule a team that actually had a pulse. There were semi-pro teams. There were foreign teams that colleges used to play. You mentioned Athletes in Action. That's actually a faith-based organization that deals around sports, and they had about 7 or 8 teams that you know would go out and play colleges and exhibition games. And there was an A team that was actually really good. You know, none of the schools I was around played them, but that A team basically had a lot of great former college players and pro players. And they would get out there, and they would beat ranked teams. I believe it was 96 or 97. They ended up beating 3 teams that made it to the Elite Eight in the 90s. They were a really good team. The Harlem Globetrotters, yes, like the Harlem Globetrotters. Now, I know it's normally performance art when you go to a Globetrotters game, but a lot of the players on the Globetrotters were former college players, and a lot of them were actually pretty good. They used to go out and play competitive games and exhibitions. And I believe, and this is where I might have a misunderstanding, UConn had the ingenious idea of scheduling a high school for their exhibition game, and it was one of the players that they were recruiting. Now, that's pretty ingenious. I mean, I thought that was pretty smart. It was a horrible game. But rather than come in and say, you're not allowed to schedule high schools, the NCAA just said, well, now you have to play other college teams. The other rule to that is you're allowed 2 dates. One, you can have an exhibition game, which is you're allowed to open it to the public and sell tickets, but if you do that, it has to be against a non-Div 1 team. The other option is that you can have a closed scrimmage against the Division 1 team, and some of them were pretty good. VCU played Florida, Gonzaga played Texas, I want to say Georgetown played, or I'm sorry, was it Georgetown that played Virginia? I mean, those would have been really good matchups. They were closed to the public, and, like, the doors were locked. I've been to a couple of those. It's so closed that you were asked to hand in your cell phones.
Yeah.
You can't even, I mean, it's ridiculous, and they all work a little differently. You know, one I was at, we played 5 12-minute, I say we, the team I was with, played 5 12-minute games. Another time they played 3 20-minute games. Another time they played a regulation 40-minute game and then spent the last hour doing situational stuff. And then the other time we actually had 2 games going on at once. So the closed scrimmages aren't actually like real games. And I think that you should definitely be allowed to do that if you want to. But I also think that if VCU in Florida wanted to open up the arena and put it on TV, they should have been allowed to do that.
And folks, David Griggs is no stranger to having to hand things in at events. It's just this is for actually an arbitrary, no reason whatsoever.
Oh, okay. All right. Now the UConn thing you mentioned, you were close. It was a traveling team where the coach of it was the high school or the AAU coach of Rudy Gay, and okay. It was just following the same sort of thing that Gary Williams used to do all the time with the Pump Brothers and the EA Sports All Stars. Once somebody else did it, and because Gary Williams really wasn't any good at recruiting, he decided to get all pissed off about it. Not that I'm bitter. But I remember also my freshman year at UConn, we played the Harlem Globetrotters in the start of the 2002-2003 team. And it was a team, I mean, Cedric Sabalos, I believe, was on that team. And really? So they were really good. You know, and it was the first game I ever attended a student, and UConn beat the Globetrotters. And, you know, yeah, they weren't throwing the bucket of confetti, but it was like, wow, they're beating the Globetrotters. This is a team that, in that year, I believe they beat Michigan State. And before then, UConn, back in the day, they didn't play Athletes in Action, but they did, they would play Marathon Oil, and I believe lost to them in 1992. So that was the traditional team UConn used to play. But nowadays, yeah, you basically have the situation where some teams, just to make the gate, they'll play the exhibitions, including the UConn men and women who played today, against CW Post, which, you know, was, I mean, at one point it was 31-5. I believe they won 117-44. You know, I mean, and if there's anyone who's less necessary of exhibition games than Gino Auriemma, I have yet to deduce who it is. But then there are some other teams like Boston College where, you know, it's really, I really think it's because most of those schools can't really draw to begin with, so drawing to an exhibition against a non-D1 team, a game they could possibly lose even, you know, isn't exactly business savvy. But I think the teams get a lot more about, you know, when you play against a team like Georgetown, it is a shame that the doors are closed. But I can understand why. I think it's a matter of not wanting to, quote-unquote, pollute the the atmosphere of evaluating teams with an exhibition game that shouldn't count. Like, if we knew that Florida blew Georgetown's doors off in an exhibition game, even though that shouldn't count in the evaluation, it'd be hard to get that out of your mind.
But this is the question I heard, and that's the thing. I heard Scott Drew talking about this. I mean, I've heard a lot of coaches talking about this, but I heard Scott Drew talk about this on Andy Katz's podcast last year. And, you know, it's just, Scott's like, you know, look, I, you know, personally, I'd rather do a close scrimmage and work on certain things where, you know, I don't have the fans expecting certain, you know, I don't have fans expecting my team to do certain things or play like a regular game because we want controlled situations. But Scott basically said, you know, if it comes down to if our athletic directors and our schools really want to keep the gate, then let's open these up, exhibitions up to, you know, to everybody. You know, let's play, you know, major teams. I mean, at the end of the day, what are we really getting out? If we're a Division I team in a major conference, what are we really getting out of this by playing Division III Pratt Institute? I mean, you know, that's the thing. It's just, I don't think for a Division I team, it's helping you to play a mid-level Division II or Division III team.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of UConn, the first team they played, now they played Southern Connecticut because they're in Connecticut, but they also do happen to be ranked number two in the preseason in D2. So at least it was a D2 team with a pulse. Yeah. Of course, their returning leading scorer did nothing, and yet they led at the half and really led most of the game.
Yeah, I don't know. And again, on Friday it won't matter. It's just, I just don't understand. And when you look at other sports, like, I don't know exactly how hockey works, but soccer, you know, you're allowed to play Div 1 teams for your exhibitions.
Right, and they do.
Yeah.
That's what the teams do. They usually play one or two.
Right.
But, it is a situation where they're playing D1 opponents, and it's a good point. Somehow those games manage not to be involved in the selection cut process, even though in a lot of cases they're good games.
Like, yeah, they are.
Plays BC. That's a good AAC, ACC teams matching up.
Right. And, you know, and don't get me wrong. I'm not saying absolutely you have to open these up. I'm just saying, because if you want a close scrimmage, like if Scott Drew would rather play Louisiana Tech, I think it was who they played, and both coaches agree that it's better for both of them to close it, then yes, you should be allowed to close it. All I'm saying is that you shouldn't have to close it. I mean, you should have the option of opening it up and having fans in the arena, and if you're, you know, if you're the road team, having the experience of this is like what it's like to stay in the hotel, and this is how the teams work, and this is how the meals work, this is how film works. I mean, it's just a better orientation than playing someone that really has no realistic shot of being competitive against you. I mean, I just think that you should have the option of opening it up if you want to, but you shouldn't have to.
Well, yeah. This kind of leads us into a similar but slightly different issue. You know, it, along the subject of, you know, a very soft opening to the season, so to speak. You know, we've got an atrocious slate of games for this weekend where there's just not much to look forward to. And unfortunately, that's kind of, I mean, the last few years, I mean, it's usually like this, but there's been some decent games. Even, you know, David's favorite aircraft carrier games. I mean, there's been some compelling matchups.
Oh, God.
But this year, much to David's chagrin, we don't have aircraft carrier games, and we really don't have much to speak of for the weekend. So I guess, you know, my next question is, it's kind of a two-part question. First, do you think that the NCAA should aim to do something to spruce up early season because it's stacked up against college football for the first month and a half? And, you know, do you think they should, you know, like make exempt season the first 2 weeks of the year to spruce up some of these big events? And also, do you think it's advantageous for coaches to go with a soft opening and ease into the schedule, or are you a fan of you know, going right into it? Lee, I'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what's happened is, I think overall, non-conference schedules and getting interesting games to watch. Now, this could be a function of the fact that the level of talent has gone down the last few years with, you know, even with one and dones, you know, it's still not the level of talent we obviously saw 20 years ago, and that's the way it is. And it's better to accept it than complain about it. It's still fun to watch, and we still love it. That's why we're doing this. I do think, though, the scheduling has gotten better, but what's happened is while you have more marquee matchups scheduled, instead of being scheduled this time of year, they're being scheduled really in the mid-December range. Things like the Champions Classic. I know UConn-Duke, they're playing on a Thursday night in December in New Jersey. And I think that's because coaches don't want to. Those games are so crucial in terms of, for teams like that, not for making the tournament, but for seeding. To have those wins are so important, and more important than most conference games they'll play. Coaches don't want to start the season with that. They want to get their, you know, their guys at least a couple weeks into the season so they can figure out rotations, they can figure out maybe they're going to get more of a contribution out of a player they didn't expect or vice versa. And they would rather work through that or a player whose conditioning wasn't up to par who needs to get back into game shape or someone who participated in like a Team USA event over the summer and just is trying to recover from having played so much over the summer and getting back into basketball shape. I think that's why you don't see these things at the beginning of the year, because those games, there's more of them now, but they're so important for seeding, and teams understand the seeding process with, you know, analytics and with the understanding how to game the RPI and scheduling's importance in determining, you know, your seed. And the teams just are wary of going into those games not at somewhat full strength. You know, you don't want to, I mean, you're not going to play them in conference season, but I'll tell you this. I mean, Kevin Ollie and UConn would much rather play Duke in February than East Carolina, but that's the way the schedules work, is that Duke's in the middle of playing North Carolina and Syracuse and Louisville. So that I think it was up to the coaches, to be honest. They would rather just play these games, you know, in January when their guys are ready for conference play and fully focused. That's why I think you don't see them to begin the season and why you're seeing them in December. But overall, I'm happy that the game, the slate seems better. I mean, 5 years ago, really, for me, was the nadir, when it felt like none of the big programs, other than the cases, would play each other out of conference, and it was just, teams were almost petrified of, you know, flaws being exposed by playing really good teams. And nobody's, you know, people realize now you don't have to win all those games. You know, you just want to be in the top six or seven seed lines. As talent is thinned out, you don't need to be a one or a two to feel like you have any chance of winning the title. You can win from a lower seed. So there's more incentive for these teams to play one another, but you still want to get as good a seed as you can. So you're going to play these games, but you're not going to play them on the first weekend. I mean, you're just, there's, you have no idea, especially for teams that are relying on star freshmen. Like, I mean, Okafor is going to be a great player for Duke, but would you rather play him in his first college game against Kansas or after four or five games when he's adjusted to the speed, the difference in ability of players you're going against, the different rules, the intensity?
Yeah, you know, I will say I think the one coach that's an exception to that is Tom Izzo. I think he enjoys the pain early on.
There's Tom Izzo and there's Dan Munson.
I suspected Izzo is probably like into S&M or something.
Well, usually, I mean, is he this year though? We'll get to this in a minute. Their schedule, I think, is legitimately disappointing, but you can make the argument it's disappointing by comparison to past years. Michigan State really lightened up this year.
Yeah, they did, and you know, maybe I know Izzo has commented several times that he probably has overdone the schedule, and I think maybe given the younger team he has this year, maybe that's why he went with a lighter schedule. You know, but David, you and I have talked about this so many times, and aside from the fact that the NCAA keeps rejecting your love letters about this issue,
well, they shouldn't. I'm gonna go there. Because I'm getting the impression they're ignoring me.
Yeah, they're ignoring a lot of people lately.
Yeah.
I'm getting that impression, too. Ignoring you for different reasons.
Okay, well, the first part of your question, as excited as I am that it's here, and I legitimately am, I mean, it is sort of like Christmas coming. It's Christmas morning, and it lasts for 5 months. I mean, I actually do like it. I do think we start a little bit too early. I think that it almost goes up against football rather than using football to complement it. Sometimes I think if we, like, it used to be the start of the non-exempt season was always the Friday before Thanksgiving. When they expanded the schedule and added two more games, I think they would have been better served to add it on to the end and play 2 weeks later rather than start 2 weeks earlier. Because, I mean, what we have now is games in the middle of football. Now, Friday night, it's not a football night. In fact, I think you see good attendance typically on the opening night of the season because it's part of that carnival atmosphere with the big football game on Saturday. Mm-hmm. But what it did, it added two games to the schedule that occur that, you know, before college basketball has really seeped into the consciousness of the general fan. It's in our consciousness, but we're not general fans. We're diehard fans. And you see a lot of half-empty houses, and that's compounded by the fact that you see a lot of mismatch, uninteresting, crappy games. I really think that it would have been better served to add 2 weeks on to the end rather than the beginning when they expanded the schedule. The second part of the question, I really think that it's a shame, just to kind of feed off what I said earlier, college basketball is the only major sport that I can think of where the beginning of the season is not a big deal. Opening day in baseball is huge. The opening week one of the NFL football season is huge. That first Thursday night game, it's a big party. They've turned it into an event. Same with college football to a large extent. College basketball does not start off with a bang. It starts off with a pop. And I mean, there is just where's the big opening ceremony? Where's the excitement? It's opening night. We're undefeated. Let's go. Let's get some good games. And there's hardly any good games. Now, we see it. We're going to see some better ones next week. The marathon's going to give us some good games. And if you look ahead to the second week of the season, you're going to start to see more compelling games. But opening night is just garbage. And it's opening night, and I kind of think that's a shame.
Well, before we get there, I want just we would touch on this, and I think we should. Something that involved, you know, this exhibition season was that the Big Ten, the ACC, and some select schools played their exhibition games using a 30-second shot clock. I mean, we've talked about the shot clock till we're blue in the face in the past. I was a fan of a shorter shot clock. It was interesting because I attended a game that had the 30-second shot clock, and there were some things I noticed that were different from it that I don't think necessarily made the game better, but at the same time, if players were more used to it, I think they could iron those issues out. I just was wondering, I guess, Kyle, you first, what was your take on the idea of playing with the 30-second shot clock for the exhibition season? I don't know if you got to watch any preseason games, you or David, and what you may have noticed that was different that you maybe didn't expect.
To be perfectly honest, I have not seen any exhibition games this year. I haven't had time to watch any. It's interesting, though, because, you know, we did that long, hour-long podcast where we kind of had the shot clock debate, you know, one side versus the other on that, and I remember David being just kind of a third wheel. For as vehemently as I was against changing the shot clock, I actually warmed up this off season to the idea of the 30-second clock. I'm not sure I would get on board with the 24-second. But I was actually warming up to the idea of the 30-second clock, and I'm glad they tried it. I haven't got to see any results here of how it's worked out so far in exhibition season, but I have warmed up to it, and I actually hope it's something they end up going to.
I don't,
David.
Well, I mean, I think that it did affect a lot of teams. In fact, watching the game today between Louisville and Bellarmine, I was kind of surprised at how it seemed. Now, I realize Bellarmine is not a Division I team, but they're a very good D2 team, and in fact, they shot, I think, 56% from the floor for the season last year, so they're a very good offensive team. And it really seemed to affect them. They couldn't get their offense going. I realize that's a weak argument. Bellarmine couldn't get their offense going against Louisville, but I was actually kind of surprised how much of an impact just lowering it 5 seconds had. My biggest fear is that one of the things I like about college basketball is that it's a smorgasbord. You have your Louisvilles, you have your really athletic-oriented teams that run up and down the floor, but you also have other styles of play like Wisconsin and Pittsburgh and, you know, some of the Ivy League schools that like to slow it down. And I just like that there's more than one road that leads to Rome. Not everybody looks the same. Not everybody plays the same. Not everybody plays the same tempo. I think 35 allows teams to slow it down and control the tempo if they're able to, without actually being able to stall the game, which I would very much be against. I mean, I'm not in favor of no shot clock. But if you go down the 30, and especially if you go down the 24, I think you eliminate some of that, and I'm against that.
Well, the things that I noticed, and I was at today the UConn versus Assumption College game. So, yeah, it's Assumption College. The difference between them and Southern is while they're both in the same conference, Assumption was like 7-9 last year in the Northeast 10. But in the first game, which I didn't attend, but I listened to on the radio, UConn played Southern Connecticut, and it was a game in which UConn won 70-62. So, field goal shooting was okay. There weren't a ton of missed shots. There were a total of 85 rebounds in the game. I mean, and UConn's a team last year that actually, I don't think people realized, got slower as the season went on and was bottom third of the country in terms of tempo. So this is a team where speeding up the clock would have made it harder for them. And they did struggle. But in person today, the stuff I noticed was that players seemed to be in a rush. There seemed to be more offensive fouls called. Not more free throws necessarily, it's offensive fouls. But players, really, it seemed like they were overthinking it, because it's not like very few schools, even schools that are deliberate on offense, I'll say to be kind, very few schools run offenses that require more than, 10, 15 seconds of setup?
Yeah, no.
I don't know if it's the teams were just starting sets later and weren't prepared for it. There seemed to be more open shots. Not more, but it wasn't more up and down, which is something I thought there would be. There were more rebounds, which I didn't anticipate, and more fouls, which I don't want. It was almost as if the players forgot what the handshake rules were, and they thought it was like last year was just an accident, and this year they'd be able to handshake. They're not. So it's definitely something where it's almost like I wonder if the players even, at least in this UConn game, knew about it. It was something that was mentioned to them. Like
this is not an accident. Lee Delvecchio even mentions Wisconsin, and David Griggs pulls out a Playboy.
Yeah, so, well, we were talking about this shit.
You keep that filth to yourself. I'm a wholesome Puritan New Englander. But I wonder if it was just something the coaches and around the country might have said, oh, yeah, by the way, it's a 30-second shot clock, because it's just an exhibition game.
Right.
But, it's college kids making decisions under pressure, and a 30-second shot clock leads to more of that. It led to a lot more possessions than I thought it would, but, they weren't very well run. So I would be okay. I was a proponent of it. I'm less of a proponent than I was originally, but I still think it would be better for the game to have 30. Now, I agree. I don't think 24 is something you need. I think that's probably going too far. But if 30-second possessions lead to more urgency, I'm sorry. I want Wisconsin and Pitt to have the right to run what it is they run. I just want them to have to do it less. If Wisconsin can still slow the ball down, but you know what? They can only do it for 30 seconds. Fine with me. I'm not preventing them from being able to run it, but I'm making them run it less, and I will not apologize.
This is perhaps this is just my OCD nature, but it's almost like two. I enjoy symmetry, and 30 seconds just makes so much sense because it just splits a minute down the half down in the halves, and 30 seconds just makes sense. I realize that's a pretty pathetic reason to be in support of it, but that's my thinking on that.
I think my personal favorite moment with it today was there was a kick ball, and it was like the refs didn't real they hadn't thought, well, what will the reset number be? They didn't know what to reset it to. I mean, I think they reset it at 19, but it was something as if they had, it would be like the NCAA to allow this and not give them any guidance on a reset number.
I would think 15 just because it's half the clock, but
right, that's what I assumed it probably was supposed to be. I mean, there was one where Assumption shot a three that was at least a second after the shot clock went off, and during the TV timeout, the ref went over to the media table and said, "I got it wrong." They didn't take the points off the board, which was weird to me. They didn't go to the monitor, but
it's an exhibition game.
Anyway, it seemed to spook the refs out as much as anything else, but it was interesting, and we'll see where that goes. I mean, at the end of the day, it was only used for, two games for each of the and a few other teams, exhibitions. So it's really hard to get much.
Right.
And for those that are wondering about this, basically the NCAA process for a rule change like this is typically they introduce it on a trial period during exhibition games, and then more or less they'll see how it goes, and later that summer the coaches will get together and decide if they like it, and if they do, then they'll probably introduce it as a rule change. Now, they actually introduced this last year, but the coaches wanted to see how it would play out some more, so they introduced it on a trial period. So we'll probably know this summer if it's going to fly or not, and I wouldn't be surprised if it goes to 30 seconds next year.
Well, yeah, they also did it at the closed scrimmages, but they were unable to collect the data on it because they could not get in to collect the data on it.
Yeah. The rule change that I think would actually help speed the game up, we can say for a fact, and it's one that, like, you couldn't even tell if you put this rule change in an exhibition because most of the time they're blowouts, is just removing a full timeout and possibly also removing the idea of a use it or lose it. That is getting one 30-second timeout and you can carry it forward if you want. I don't think you'd want to give an extra one if you still have it after the first half, so you'd have two. But the use it or lose it timeout leads to teams taking timeouts just for the sake of taking timeouts. Right. And inevitably, those possessions still come down to ISO plays. And it's just those, to me, are actually a bigger waste of time than the extra full timeout you have. But I think it'll be easier bureaucratically to just get rid of one more full timeout. I just think reducing the number of timeouts, I mean, do you need five? You should.
I've always.
It's 16, 12, 8, and 4 in the first call timeout of each half. Isn't it 10? Like, yeah. There's 10 media timeouts, and that adds 40 minutes to the game.
Yeah, not to sell ads, but the team timeouts, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it is somewhat. Four of them are. But if you just took care of one, you know, TV would still get the same number of ads to sell. You just wouldn't have that one timeout where they keep it there and they're just talking about God knows what on air. So yeah. That, for me, I'll be honest, I've changed. At this point, I want a 30-second shot clock, but I want a reduction in timeouts a lot more. I mean, that's a direct
impact. Anybody who saw the Wisconsin-Arizona game this past year, I mean, that game is the epitome of why something needs to be done about the end-of-game situation. Because that game...
It's the simultaneous timeouts, too. It's The timeout after a timeout because we've seen the look. When we all know it's going to friggin' change.
Yeah.
Because we know they're going to call the timeout. It's such a dramatic waste of time.
The last 2 minutes of that Arizona-Wisconsin game literally took about a half hour. I mean, it was absolutely cool.
No, it was amazing. Anyway, speaking of waste of time, since you guys have kind of alluded to it, well, Friday night sees the start of the season. As I mentioned earlier, 112 games that will count for the selection committee for the 2015 Division I Men's Basketball Championship, and 45 pointless bloodbaths, which should have some comedy therein. So I'll start with you, David. Looking ahead to Friday night or Friday's schedule, what game catches your eye?
There's one that catches my eye like you wouldn't believe. I believe it's Friday night. Okay. It is Missouri's home opener. And they are taking on the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Now, it's close. It's not. They're not playing Kansas like they should be. And are we going to get into why Missouri should play Kansas?
We are definitely not.
But
I think that topic is
the biggest rivalry of all time. But it's just...
Oh, David Driggs got the mute. Oh, we're in the first official podcast of the season. He's already been muted.
Here it comes. Wait for it.
That's got to suck.
Yep, there it is. all right, so he's picked his. Kyle, yours?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, the only one that I could possibly be interested in on Friday is probably Minnesota-Louisville because it's the only one where two teams with a pulse are playing one another on the same floor.
Neutral site.
What?
Oh, sorry. What did you say?
Live television. I think we lost. Did we lose the bear?
No, the bear is still here.
Oh, okay.
The bear lost you.
No, but anyway, so that's, yeah, Louisville, Minnesota, 7 o'clock tip-off in Puerto Rico. So it will be, it's a neutral site game, so that's an interesting one. Is there something specific you're looking for other than the Richard Pitino hype to come crashing back to Earth?
Well, you know, this is kind of an interesting game because both teams come in probably a little overhyped. I mean, I think Minnesota, the expectations with a lot of people are that they're going to be a solid tournament team this year. I think that's possible. I don't personally see it, but I think it's possible. But then, you know, Louisville is probably a little overhyped and maybe even overrated at number 8 as well.
Well, they blew out the number 10 team in the country today.
Yeah, number 10 team in Division 2 for folks that are not catching that sarcasm.
Well, you can spin the facts however you want to, Kyle, but I mean, they did beat the number 10 team in the country badly.
You know, one other game, or actually one other team I do want to keep an eye on. This is a subject I kind of wanted to bring up. You know, while I'm thinking about it, and I'll throw it to you first, because you know you've got the right shade of blue for this, and you're no stranger to scandals. What do you make of this UNC situation? You know, the News Observer in Charlotte just came out with another story here this weekend, where basically, you know, the 2005 North Carolina basketball team had 35 no-show classes taken by the team just that year alone. We're starting to see a lot more information come out on this, and it's starting to pile up, and it's hard to imagine UNC escaping this without some sort of postseason ban or something else. Is this going to be a distraction, and do you think UNC is in trouble for this season? I mean, we're talking about a top 10 team right now, at least theoretically on paper.
Right. Well, the way the rules are written, I think other than being utterly humiliating and embarrassing, I don't really know how extensive the NCAA violations really go. Now, if the athletes were getting special favors, that's a violation. If it was academic dishonesty, a situation where someone was doing the work for them, or they were plagiarizing and it wasn't being caught or something like that, that's a violation. I think what ended up happening here was that it was an entire academic department at the university, African American Studies, that essentially 20 years ago or however long it was, basically stopped working. They stopped teaching, they stopped doing lesson plans, and they were just giving out grades. And they had, I think, an administrative assistant grading papers and giving A's. I saw something once that there was a professor that had independent studies, and I guess he's getting paid for all these. He was teaching 300 independent studies classes in one semester, and that is just comedically absurd that something like that would go overlooked. So what they ended up doing was saying, well, there's no more independent studies, and they ended up just having classes, but the classes essentially amounted to nothing. They never met. There was no instruction. There were no assignments. But I think the loophole here is that because these were classes that were open to the entire student body and not just the athletes, that it may not be a violation, because under academic freedom, the NCAA can't really come in and dictate how easy or hard a curriculum needs to be. And then, like, SACSCOC, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, essentially the accrediting body for the state, for the University of North Carolina, you would think that they would be all over this, and they weren't. They basically came out and said, all we can really do is issue a public reprimand. Well, if SACSCOC, which is one of the worst acronyms, SACSCOC, that I could imagine, somehow very appropriate here, given what's going on. If they can't do anything, then what can the NCAA do if the accrediting body can't do anything either? I just basically, to get back to your question, Kyle, I'm really not sure. I think it's very embarrassing for the school. I do think there's some athletic violations that they will get in trouble for. I don't believe for a second that the coaches didn't know. That's absurd. We all went to college or we all went to high school, and every student on campus knows who the easy teachers are and what the easy classes are. The idea is that the coaches and the athletic advisors did not is almost ridiculous. But I don't think it's, at least on paper, what can the NCAA really do?
Lee, what's the over-under on when Roy Williams has his first media blow-up about this topic?
Well, it already happened at ACC Media Day. I mean, so we're past that. Roy didn't know anything. It's amazing how he doesn't know anything, but his hand-picked academic advisor who came with him from Kansas. First thing, I'll be honest, at some point, doesn't somebody have to go knocking on some doors at Kansas? Because this academic advisor worked there for 20 years. And, you know, I'm sure they didn't just come up with this.
David Griggs has been knocking on the door at Kansas for the last 10 years.
Fair.
Well, I've been trying to get them to play a certain amount of conference game for the last couple of years.
Y'all, just mute them now. I'm interested with how this is developed, because when we got the full report, it was, well, they have to investigate and see how, if any players on the 05 team were involved before we just assumed that that's going to be. And then the report goes, yeah, no, they were very involved. So I wonder if, I mean, 05 I think will get vacated. I wonder about 93, considering how far back this goes. I don't think it goes back
at least that far.
But you have to look, right? And nobody has even discussed the stain this could be on Dean Smith's reputation. Nobody's discussed that. And also 09, Bears looking into. I mean, every season Bears looking into. But, I mean, there are massive ramifications on a historical basis. We've never had a school vacate a national championship, yet alone possibly three. I think they definitely lose the 05 one. I don't think they'll get a postseason ban.
I don't either.
Supposedly, I mean, I don't know why people are believing this, but supposedly this got all cleaned up, you know, around 2011.
Well, what ended up happening is that they did an extensive study, and it turned out that those professors had tenure, so it's fine.
Yeah. But it's an absolute mess. I don't think it'll affect the team this year at North Carolina as much as, you know, Roy Williams will. But you know, it's going to be a story. It's obviously not going away. And the NCAA is going to – I mean, this is such a massive fraud. I mean, over 20 years.
Yeah.
It's not just losing one championship, but it's interesting, the pyramid effect. I have a friend who's a North Carolina fan. I said, don't worry, you know – there's plenty of room here in the four national championship club if you're nice. I mean, but if you're really jerks, it could be the two national championship club. Considering what they could lose historically. But back to this Friday night, a game I've got an eye on. You know, it's not a great schedule. You know, of course, Bruce Weber's first game as the head coach at Auburn, 10 p.m. tip-off, and it's the Milwaukee Panthers. The whole gang is getting back together.
You mean Bruce Pearl?
Yeah, but Bruce Weber, I'm fairly confident, is not
Pearl. I'm sorry, Bruce Pearl.
Yeah.
Bruce Weber. No, this is a good
game. Oh, that's great theater.
Bruce Pearl, first game, 10 p.m. tip-off. You know, the weekend, I believe Auburn, I think their body bag football game is this weekend.
You know what? And this is a true story. You cannot make this up. Bruce Pearl's first game is in Las Vegas. I mean, first of all, that is an absolute disastrous decision by the.
According to KenPom, it's at Auburn.
Oh, you know what? It may be one of those, because this is okay. That may be true. It's the MGM Grand main event, but it may be one of those preliminary games.
Yeah, but they're playing the Milwaukee Panthers, the school that he led to such great prominence in the early 2000s in the NCAA tournament before the fall. And, Auburn, he did a great job, I thought. You want to talk about the fifth-year transfer rule. Has anybody benefited more in the offseason than Auburn?
No. I mean, it's to a point to where they could actually be somewhat relevant. I think they're a mile from the tournament, but they might not be at the bottom of the league.
One of my bold predictions this year is that he puts this team in the tournament. I'm not entirely – I'm not kidding. He's an excellent coach.
Oh, he is.
KT Harrell from Virginia, Kareem Canty from Marshall, Casey Ross Miller from New Mexico State. Antoine Mason is really the gem of the players he got. Only Mason and Ross Miller will be eligible this year in terms of transfers, but Antoine Mason is a scorer. He's a 6'1 guard who I think can have a huge impact for that team. And I really think that Bruce Pearl is going to get the Tigers in the discussion in what is still not a very good basketball league. You know, hey, third place in the SEC is a hell of a chip to have still in the committee room, even if the SEC stinks.
They've got an opportunity to win a lot of games. I don't think they have an opportunity to win enough quality games that'll get them in the tournament. I just don't. Their margin for error is almost. I mean, it's almost non-existent just because...
They're going to be that team this year who has a gaudy record, and we're going to have some very long arguments over.
Yeah, because, I mean, they don't even... And one of the things that hurts them is they don't even get Florida or Kentucky at home. They have to play them both on the road, but they don't get them at home. So there's not a very good chance of being able to get a win. Now, if they go into Gainesville or into Lexington and pull off a win, then we're talking about a whole different story, but they don't get the opportunity. those home wins against.
I mean, I think if they win both of those, they might be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. But it kicks off this Friday, and it begins very early. Eastern Washington started the college football season playing Sam Houston State at home on the Saturday before, the third Saturday in August, and they decided, you know what, we'll do the same thing. We'll be the first team in the country to start the college basketball season as
Austin. Who's Austin? Who is that?
Who?
Austin, whoever Sam Houston's playing.
It's Austin.
No, I'm not talking about that. No. They're playing the second game of the year, Sam Houston. But the first game of the year in college basketball will be hosted by the team that hosted the first football game of the year in college football. The Eastern Washington Eagles will be hosting Mike Davis's Texas Southern at 11 in the morning Eastern. That is an 8 a.m. at Reese Court.
Wow. I was not aware of that.
On a Friday.
And the winner is going to be tops of the RPI for a couple hours.
No. Texas Southern, I kind of like them in this game.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I just said. The winner is going to be on top of the RPI for a couple of hours. Big
moment. And then at 1 p.m., the aforementioned Sam Houston State hosts Austin. At 1:30, Eastern Michigan hosts St. Francis.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that. Where's that Eastern Washington game?
The Eastern Washington game is at Eastern Washington.
Oh, there it is. Okay, I'm showing it at 1:30. My website must have bad information.
No, it's 8 a.m. local.
Oh, that's Eastern Michigan. I don't even... Okay, yeah. It's not on the list I'm looking at. I'm not going to say who it is because I really like this site. But, yeah, the site I'm looking at does not have that game.
There's Fairfield against Central Connecticut, the first game of the triple header extravaganza that is the Connecticut Six Classic. This year, Quinnipiac's hosting it. We've got Fairfield. It's interesting because there's some good teams in the state besides UConn this year. Fairfield, again, who's rebuilding against Central Connecticut, which will be the pick to win the NEC in the preseason. Yale-Quinnipiac, that one's kind of the snoozer of the group. And those are the only two games that day. But the other, you know, Hartford should be good this year. Sacred Heart's just, you know, body on the schedule. But you also have BMI against the Citadel, always good to see. And that's part of the Armed Forces Classic that Army is hosting. That game's at 5:30. Hiwassee, Chattanooga at 5:30. Yale, Quinnipiac at 5:30. And then the first game involving a team that you might care about this year. Bill and Mary are at Florida to start the season. They started the season at UConn in 2012, so they William and Mary, another tough road opener for them. And then Presbyterian at Duke in what will be the bloodbath of the evening. That is both those games, Florida and Duke, are hosting at 6 p.m. Eastern. So those are the first two games if you want just any college basketball that might be worth watching for at least a TV timeout, possibly two. 6 p.m. Friday, Gainesville and Durham will be the place to be.
Yeah, I got one that I sort of got my eyes on. I'm not expecting much out of Georgia Tech this year, but Georgia is one of my sleepers. I'm a little curious to see what they can do on the road at Georgia Tech. Now, that's not going to be a great road win, but if they go in there and get a road win, it's an indication that maybe they can play their way close to the bubble.
And that's a game that actually has a little bit of, you know, atmosphere there. Those two schools obviously hate one another. I don't know. Kyle, is it too much to ask to think that'll be a charged atmosphere?
It's a little too much to ask, yeah. I to be honest, one of the things that's going to hurt is I don't even think school's in session there for this week. It's going to be a dull atmosphere if my hunch is correct.
Why is it school in session?
It usually is. There's one game. It's not an interesting slate, but I'm just looking for stuff. One game later that evening, which kicks off one of my favorite annual traditions of just things I respect. And, you know, Long Beach State, Dan Monson, the man will go anywhere and play anyone.
Yes.
And on Friday night he begins as the Beach travels to BYU. I guess I'll start with you, David. What are your thoughts on maybe this BYU team this year And is this a chance for Long Beach State really to get a good road win in a place that's very tough to win historically?
Well, I like BYU a lot this year. I do think they're going to end up inside the bubble. They weren't in our preseason podcast because they didn't get a vote in the coaches poll, but I do think that they'll be the second team in out of the West Coast. I'm normally a fan of Long Beach. They've had some really good teams in the past. They've had some teams that got very close to the bubble. They ended up not needing it at large, but they've had some good teams. This year, I just don't think they have it. I like UC Irvine out of that conference a lot. I like Santa Barbara a lot. I just don't see it with Long Beach this year. It's interesting. It's one of the more compelling games by the standards of tonight. But if they were playing later in the next week, I don't even think it would be on the radar. It's just a bad night.
What do you think, Kyle? Is the Big West just the Alan Williams show this year?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's gotten to the point where, like, I basically the only reason I had to even watch the Big West is like, okay, it's 12:30 in the morning. Let's see if Hawaii or somebody is on right now. I mean, that's,
you mentioned that. You mentioned Hawaii, an awful first day.
It's incredible.
David knows where I'm going. The final game of Friday night, Arkansas Pine Bluff at Hawaii, 12:30 a.m. Folks, who needs sleep? I mean, if you're watching that game, honestly, you need help. You seriously?
I'll be watching that game.
You're also a puppet on a podcast about college basketball. I think we've already established that one. Yeah, that might be the worst game of the day, and it starts at 12:30. But Long Beach, another amazing non-conference schedule. Road games at BYU, Xavier, UCLA, Stephen F. Austin, San Diego State, Texas, St. John's, Syracuse, and Louisville. They play two non-D1 teams, and I'm upset they don't play four, just to make it fair. This schedule, this might be the toughest schedule I've ever seen Dan Monson put together. This is – the SWAC can't put together schedules like this.
It's pretty rough.
In the month of December, they're at Stephen F. Austin, San Diego State, Texas, St. John's, Syracuse, and Louisville.
Well, I'm just glad that they're finally stepping up to play somebody. I mean, it's about time Dan Monson grew some balls.
The flip side of this is when you play as many games like this, you do get some – once in a while you'll get a home game, and this year they actually get Kansas State at home the week before Thanksgiving. So that'd be an interesting game to keep an eye on. What should be a tough game for Kansas State on the road, and it's about time Long Beach State got one of these games at home. They get once every couple of years. I feel like North Carolina comes in there, but with all these contracts, so many of them are one-offs. It's a shame they don't get more home games, and they aren't hunting for cash.
No, they're not. This is a scheduling strategy that he believes in. He tried to do it at Gonzaga. Now, he didn't have as much luck, but Dan Monson would play – he would play the Miami Heat, or who's the best team, the Spurs, if he were allowed to. He loves to play a tough schedule. I think this is a little bit overkill. They are getting paid. I'm all for teams challenging themselves. I think that's what you need to do. I don't think enough teams challenge themselves enough. There's a lot that don't. But I also think it's possible to overwhelm yourself. This is the antithesis of what Stu Morrill does. I mean, this is unbelievable.
At what point are you hurting your players' confidence? But this is a team that's got I haven't checked if these players are returning. I presume they are. Michael Caffey, Tyler Lamb, A.J. Spencer, David Samuels, four seniors returning, along with Chris Gulley and Michaela Sal, who were really barely contributors, off the bench. So it's a team – it's an older team. Those were limited guys. They also, in terms of bench warmers, Nick Shepard and Christian Griggs-Williams, no relation, I presume, David.
Yeah.
No relation to Christian Griggs-Williams.
He likes to admit, no.
This is a team with, like, eight seniors on it. So I really think they're going to pull off one of those games. I don't know which. Probably the safe bet has got to be St. John's, I would think. But I don't know, Stephen F. Austin's a possibility, although they had a great year last year. you know, they're going to – that Fresno Pacific game that comes after the Stephen F. Austin, San Diego State, Texas, St. John's, Syracuse, Louisville swing, Fresno Pacific's going to get the holy hell beat out of them by an angry team on January 3rd.
I got one for you on Saturday. It is a mismatch, but it is a game of intrigue, and we'll take it when we can get it. A lot of people are big on this SF Brooklyn. Or what do they like to be called? SFNY that doesn't like to be called SFNY.
St. Francis, New York.
St. Francis, New York. Is it New York or Brooklyn? What do they like to be
LIU
called?
LIU is Brooklyn. LIU is Brooklyn. SFNY.
No, it's also St. Francis, Brooklyn.
St. Francis, Brooklyn. Okay.
They don't go usually with the Brooklyn because of LIU.
The team that used to be called SFNY but doesn't like to be called SFNY is going to Georgetown. Now, this is the favorites out of the Northeast Conference, which is a perennial 15-16.
Central's better.
Yeah, Central is better. In fact, I don't get a lot of the SFNY, excuse me, formerly known as SFNY love, but they were picked to win at Media Day for some strange reason.
Well, here's the reason why. Central's best player is Kyle Vanellis, and he kind of possibly assaulted his girlfriend physically. So he may never come back, and without him, Central's not nearly the same team.
Oh.
And with him, he's an enigma.
Do you have any more happy news, Lee?
No, I know, really. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think they were picked before that, though. So, yeah, they're the pick out of the NEC, and Georgetown, I mean, they live to lose this kind of game, don't they?
They do. So there is a reason to tune in that night. Today, I believe it's a noon tip.
Yeah, it's a noon game at the Verizon Center.
Okay.
So there's that. The last thing I kind of wanted to, unless you guys have a lot more to delve into in this wonderful weekend of games.
Tulsa, Oral Roberts. Oh.
There's obviously going to be one of those games where a non-D1 team either comes close to winning or actually wins. Do any of you gentlemen have a pick of the litter? I have one, but I'll let you go first.
I do not. UAB lost their exhibition game. I believe they're the only team that's lost one so far to a non-Div 1 team, and that was an exhibition.
You really don't have to aim high.
Right, yes.
I mean, if it's happening to UAB, you don't just have to look at the bottom of right. one, but I've got one. Huston Tillotson at Texas San Antonio. This is a Texas San Antonio team that's really fallen on hard times the last few years. They're a team that's been to multiple NCAA tournaments. The move into Conference USA was a big step up for them, and I wonder if, you know, they have the it wouldn't shock me to see them struggle with Huston Tillotson. This is a team that's barely in the top 300. I hope it doesn't happen. I have a soft spot for UTSA. Twice they made the tournament, UConn's won the title. So they're kind of always a fan favorite out here. That's one. Another one that I would not be shocked by, at the least, is, you know, one that I'm going to keep an eye on. I don't think there's a chance of it happening, but Harvard, who's in the top 25, opens the season against MIT. That should be a crazy atmosphere at Levates Pavilion up in Boston with all the MIT students there. And
wait, are they going to MIT?
No. It's at Harvard, but MIT. Okay. We'll have a lot of fans there. It's in the city.
Yeah,
there'll be a lot of atmosphere. There's an unbelievable excitement around this Harvard team for good reason.
Right. Lee, a little bit of trivia here. They've opened against MIT before. Is this the third or fourth year in a row they've opened against MIT? This is becoming a fixture game for them.
It's become basically the fixture opener for them. Other games to keep an eye on, I actually don't have the D2, D3 rankings, but Texas Tyler Incarnate Word. I actually think that's the best chance of getting some sort of quote-unquote upset. Or Hillsdale at a terrible Abilene Christian team. Just a horrific basketball team.
Yeah.
So Hillsdale or Texas Tyler could land the money jackpot on Friday night. Favorite name, by the way, Friday night for non-D1 team, Barber Scotia at Campbell.
What I want to ask you two about is, this is looking ahead to Sunday, so we'll be on the air probably just a couple hours after this one ends. Boston College at UMass.
Yeah, I mean, Kyle, you want to go first? I've been talking a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know, but when I want to turn around my team and I'm in the ACC, Kyle, would you be looking towards Jim Christian's work at TCU as your first choice? I mean, So now, I'll tell you this. Supposedly they were turned down, BC, by Amaker and, you know, by other Ivy League level options, which
they
let them
play Harvard, though, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, look, Jim Christian wouldn't have been my fifth or sixth selection, but this game, UMass-BC, is probably the most interesting game as part of the... They're doing a tournament similar to what they do in Connecticut, where they're having the six state schools play a triple header at the TD Garden in Boston. So it actually has a couple interesting games, or games that should be close. I mean, UMass-BC is interesting. Northeastern BU is actually the first game at 12:30. Then it's UMass-BC at 3, and it closes out with Holy Cross-Harvard at 5:30. But Kyle, do you have any thoughts on UMass-BC? I mean, this is a UMass team that made the tournament last year and just, you know, for the first time in a long time, but it did not go well.
Yeah, I do feel the need to point out that it's a UMass team that made the tournament, and it's a Boston College team that did not make the tournament.
Tournament and did not come close to making the tournament.
And, you know, and I still see, I mean, I don't deal with them every day like maybe you do, but I still see so many disillusioned BC fans that think this is the year that BC becomes competitive again. And
No, that's not right. No, that is incorrect. This is the year they lose, what, their fifth straight year to Harvard? That's what this year is. Yeah. This year is a year in which Ken Pom projects them to win one game in the ACC, and that's the final game of the season against Wake Forest by 3.
So, I know, that's the thing, but, you know, it's a new coach, so it's a new fantasy.
Yeah, okay, that's the good news. The bad news, David Griggs, the new coach is Jim Christian.
Yes. Oh, boy.
Now, he had 2 good years at Ohio. 2, as in he inherited good players from Kyle Lamb's, you know, significant other, John Gross. do you have any thoughts on Jim Christian, David?
I think that it is the perfect fit for Boston College. I think they deserve each other, and it makes sense. And I mean all of that in the worst possible way.
Oh, boy.
I don't understand. It just wasn't. I don't. Boston College, when you look at the pool of coaching candidates that I think they could have gotten, one of which is who Ohio University hired to replace him, Saul Phillips. If you had your choice between Saul Phillips and Jim Christian, why in the world would you go with Jim Christian? I don't know. I just think BC could have done a lot better. And
well, they could have done a lot better. It would have been hard to. I mean, this team's at TCU were that was Mountain West TCU. That wasn't, they're in the Big 12 TCU. This was... They were, I mean, they went 1-15 in 2011 in the Mountain West.
Yeah.
His Mountain West records in 4 years, and that's the only conference he's coached in that was, I mean, that wasn't the MAC. So, I mean, the ACC is a whole different animal. His 4 years in the MAC, or in the Midwest, or Mountain West Conference, 5-11, 5-11, 1-15, 7-7. I mean, it's just, and got the Ohio job out of that. I mean, which is, I still don't understand how that happened. Kyle, do you have any insight into how that happened?
A little bit, but it's kind of betraying some confidences, but
that's
what we're all about here, betraying confidence.
He had 20 wins in his 6 years at Kent State. I assume that helped.
Yeah, no, it did. I mean, look, the thing is, you know, one thing that Ohio, let's just put it this way, I mean, Ohio schools are very... they're very loyal to guys that have inroads with Ohio high school coaches. It's a very cult-like atmosphere within the coaches association. And Jim Christian had basically known a lot of people down there, and that really that helped him a lot. It's interesting because Saul Phillips, obviously, funny thing is, Saul Phillips doesn't really have any connections in Ohio. But I know he came very well, very high recommended. There was a connection to Bo Ryan and Saul Phillips being a Bo Ryan disciple.
He had another connection. He had a connection to Tim Miles.
Oh, there you go.
Miles, who right now is getting ready to take on Well, they're not technically eligible for the postseason, but he's got a big, big game this weekend against one of the top teams in the RPI currently, Northern Kentucky. He's getting ready.
Yes, they're currently tied with 350 teams for first. Just by the way, Jim Christian's teams at TCU, in effective field goal defense, their national rankings were 284, 323, 287, and 329. So good luck this year playing Syracuse, Louisville, North Carolina, and Duke. You know, good luck defending on that front, BC. Look, what he's returned BC to is one thing. As a friend of mine who's a BC season ticket guy said, and with a straight face.
They have those? Are you sure?
One or two.
You're going to want to look into that.
They've returned to recruiting actual basketball players again. So the recruiting isn't great, but they're recruiting, you know, guys who can probably compete in the ACC, unlike everybody ever brought in by Steve Donahue, who was a tire fire disaster, and who I can't believe didn't get an Ivy job, by the way. Like, how he isn't back at Cornell yet, I don't know.
Yeah, they've struggled a little bit.
Let me ask you, if you're a basketball coach, and this is a scary thought, if you're a basketball coach, would you rather be coaching at Boston College, given the limitations of who you can recruit, or would you rather be at TCU?
I would rather be at TCU.
Are those my only two choices?
Yes. We're putting yourself in the shoes of Jim Christian.
Yeah, I would rather be at TCU. The newer facilities, because they've renovated the basketball arena. You're in a better recruiting area. You've got a more committed fan base, even for basketball, and it's an easier road to go in the Big 12 than it is in the ACC.
Well, and I mean, look, that's exactly how I feel. I kind of feel like Jim Christian made a serious career mistake there.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, BC can offer a lot of money. It's a very well-funded school. So anyway, this game against UMass, it'll be their second game. They open Friday night against the perennial New England doormat known as the University of the University of New Hampshire. UConn is in Hockey East now, so I have to learn to hate these schools. So their second game is the UMass game. David, what do you think of this UMass team that's coming back from making the tournament? We talked about BC. They stink. Let's talk about the team that was actually good last year under Derek Kellogg, the Minutemen, who opened Friday night with a kind of a tough test at home against Siena, and then BC on Sunday.
Well, I think we're going to learn a lot more about them after this weekend, because although Siena and BC aren't great, they're good enough to where I think you will be able to judge UMass somewhat. I don't know that much about them. I have more questions than answers. They were good last year, but they lost a lot. It'll be interesting to see how they adjust to that. They were, in my opinion, one of last year's more legitimate surprises. I didn't think they'd make the NIT. They weren't really on my radar at all until like a couple weeks into the season where it was like, hey, this team's pretty good, so we'll see what they do again.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like that they were a team that kind of a year they reached the peak of what they could be a year after we expected it. We really had expectations for them in 2013. They have an interesting schedule this year. They have neutral site games with Notre Dame and Florida State. They have away games at Harvard. I mean, it helps all the Massachusetts teams play Harvard. It helps everyone. Harvard's really good. They play at LSU in a return game of what was a great game last year. Play at Providence, which will be fascinating, and at BYU. So, and also a home game with Iona. So there's a lot of top 100 quality teams in there. The question is, will they be able
to... Siena's good, too. I mean, I know that they're... Well, Siena and Iona are both good. That's one of the better games on Friday, I think. That Siena game. Unfortunately, they're bringing Jim Cluse with them.
Tim Cluse.
They can bring Tim Cluse, yes. Cluse.
Maybe he would know how to use timeouts. Right. I got to be fair. He's done a better job at Iona than I thought he would.
Yeah.
But, you know, and... UMass, I mean, Ken Pom preseason has them fifth in the A-10, and obviously I don't expect the A-10 to be nearly what it was last year, but it's still a very solid top 10, easily a top 10 league. And
it's a multi-bid league. I think that they, I mean, if you finish in the top two or three, you got a very good shot of being inside the bubble.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I guess any final thoughts, Kyle?
You know, just one last game. I kind of want to point out that interests me on Saturday. Not a big deal, but just given a history of losing games like this early in the season, I'm interested to see the Manhattan Jaspers against Florida State. Obviously, Steve Masiello is back, has completed his degree, and so his resume is no longer fraudulent. But, you know, Florida State has a history of losing these types of games. This Manhattan team is a younger version than what they put out in the NCAA tournament last year. But, you know, I think they're going to be competitive. They're going to be play that up-tempo style. They're not going to be easy to play against. I kind of wouldn't be surprised if Manhattan upsets Florida State here.
I wouldn't be either.
No, I would not be either. This is they absolutely live to lose games like this. And I'm taking a look at a team I want to interested to watch. Their first game is not Friday, but on Saturday, or actually is Friday night, and it's a game they should win easily, but the post-Doug McDermott era starts at Creighton as they take on Central Arkansas. So there's that. It'll be interesting. They should roll them. And also, I mean, two teams that were new to the Big East last year. I'm interested to watch Creighton this year without McDermott and Butler, where this coaching situation is just a mess. And David, you could actually speak more to that, being that you drink frequently on air and know Butler.
Right. I'm actually really, really curious and excited to see what Butler does with the new coach. Oh my God, I can't think of his name all of a sudden.
Holtman?
Thank you, Chris Holtman. Like he came from Gardner Webb, and he did a very good job. His first year there, they won 5 Div 1 games, and then by year 3, they were a 20-plus year winner, one of the better teams in the Big South. Now, they never got to the NCAA tournament, but the guy could really coach. The guy could really develop players. When Butler hired him as an assistant last year, I was genuinely shocked because he had more coaching experience and success and was more proven, ultimately, than the guy that he was replacing. So it was kind of surprising to see, why would you leave a head coaching job, especially when he was getting attention at bigger programs to be another head coach outside the Big South to go to Butler. I am really curious to see what they do this year. It might look like a mess, but it might actually turn out to be better than what anybody else is expecting it to be.
I would agree with that. I don't think Butler really ever wanted Brandon Miller to be their head coach. He played there and is a legend there, but in terms of coaching, he got the job when, you know, Brad Stevens left. It was caught everyone by a shock. He didn't. They were not very good last year. He's got this, you know.
It wasn't a shock. In basketball circles, it was expected, actually.
All right, that's fair. But I feel like Butler at that point had talked themselves into, he's never leaving, you know. now that they've got Holtman, I think he's a better coach.
He is.
Butler wants success so they can just, you know, really go with him full time. He's got a much better pedigree, and to be honest, he's more qualified for the job.
He really is. And Butler, they lost a key player before the season started to injury. He's back now. A lot of those games in conference, they were 4-14, but they were competitive games. I said this way, way back. Butler is one of my dark horses this year. I wouldn't be surprised to see them make the NIT or maybe even the NCAA.
All right. Well, final thoughts. I guess Kyle touched on one there. David, do you have any other than projecting Butler as a possible tournament team?
That was one of my final thoughts. One of the things I would like to say is when you look at the major conferences and the teams that are in the top 25 now, you see a lot of teams with a lot of new players. When you go under the radar, so to speak, when you look at Murray State and SFA and Iona, and Louisiana Tech and Harvard and a lot of these teams that come from the so-called one-bid leagues, you see like seven of the top 8 back. You see a lot of players returning, a lot of teams returning 4 starters, 5 starters, and their bench. So it's just interesting to see, is this one of those years where we see a lot of good teams outside the major conferences just because of the experience difference that they have coming back?
And folks, these are all places that have not yet banned David Griggs from campus.
Yeah, yet. Well, again, you say banned, I say I was asked not to come back. There's a difference.
And for me, I'm just excited to see how Tom Crean manages to struggle to beat Mississippi Valley State on Friday night, if he's still the coach then. Well, that does it pretty much, I think, for us.
That place is a train wreck. Oh, my gosh.
The people at the Lionel Company take offense to that. I mean, it's bad. It's
a great line.
But Galen's discussed that enough, and he couldn't join us tonight.
Folks, this is my last one. Indiana this offseason with the basketball program, please go to your nearest computer, pull up google.com, and just do some searches. I mean, that place is an epic failure right now. I feel so bad for Galen. It's right there on site. I mean, it's a very bizarre thing going on there right now.
It to call it a tire fire is insulting to both tires and fires. Yes.
All right, guys. Well, it's back on Friday. It's not impressive. Right. It's not a great schedule, but it's back in our lives. And
it's back, yes.
You can distract me from college hockey, because fuck college football.
All right.